Swing and a Miss, written by Owl Winter, narrated by Rhea 314, fandom The Nine World Series by Victoria Goddard, rating general audiences, no archive warning supply. Relationship, Arturin Damara, aka Fitzroy Angersell, and Cleofer Kip Medang. Your wine seems to have acquired the subtle taste of poison. You detect it on the first sip, of course. Back when you were Maroon, you had been trained on all of the usual poisons. And then, because apparently that wasn't torturous enough, all of the less usual poisons to boot. It had been a miserable time, months and months spent sweating and vomiting as your body built its immunities. From the reflective light of your dutifully ever-glowing skin, you can see an almost imperceptible sheen of purple skimming across the top of your wine, which does wonders in terms of narrowing down what the poison could be. The sip you had consumed had tasted fruity. Now that's a flavor you've missed, which narrows it down even more. You take a moment to dredge through your little-used mental list of poisons. Seabane, most likely. You can vaguely recall the poison as being one distilled from a cone snail dwelling in the wide sea islands. That poison had been particularly hellish to adjust to when you had been Maroon. And it gives you a rather absurd amount of delight knowing that that particular training had not been in vain. Pointing out the poison would certainly mean the execution of your kitchen staff, and you are quite confident in your immunity of the poison, so after a moment of consideration, you drink the entire glass. The fruity taste the poison adds to the wine is just a bonus, but you will at least admit to yourself that it is the best wine you've had in years. The poison finds its way into your meals a handful of times over the following week in increasingly absurd concentrations. You can't get enough of it. The fruity flavor it adds is utterly delectable. It would be absurd to request your kitchens deliberately add the poison to your meals, but you let yourself enjoy your assassin's unintentional gifts, even so. Eventually, your assassin must come to the conclusion that Seabane is ineffective on you, because, to your not-so-mild dismay, they begin to branch out in their methodology. You notice a toxin dabbed across your budget report, along with some rather savage, if enlightening, annotations. A poison needle in the sleeves of one of your silk gowns. Almost a blessing, you had been wondering how you could convince the Orda Natha to let you have a sewing needle. A venomous caterpillar crawling on the great golden armrests of your throne. Far more entertaining to watch than the inept dances of the nobles below you. If your assassin wasn't evidently trying so hard to kill you, you'd have named them your dearest of allies. The assassin's range and methodology is nothing short of magnificent. How on earth are they able to get access to so many different aspects of your life? It is possible that they are disguising themselves as your servant. Or, better yet, perhaps they are one of your servants. You scrutinize the faces of those around you with renewed interest, but notice nothing beyond the usual stale flavors of fawning and worship. The most fascinating part of it all is how stringently your assassin works to avoid harming anyone other than you. You have no idea how they manage it. Tactically given cures, perhaps, or just extremely precise timing on the applications of the poisons. Either way, it must add a frankly ridiculous amount of planning to their assassination attempts. An assassin with morals, how delightful, how absurd. Since there is no real harm in letting your assassin continue to try and murder you, you are content to leave them be for the time being. And their attempts do expose a whole host of security problems to you. How on earth did your assassin get access to your bathwater? At some point, you'll need to send your guards out to try and catch your assassin. But for now, your assassin's stubborn and completely ineffective persistence is amusing. The assassination attempts do wonders in terms of breaking up the tedium of your theoretically divine existence, if nothing else. You are in your private study the first time you meet your assassin face to face. You had been in the middle of reading a rather dull book about the economic situation in Hyon City when, without any warning, you feel the touch of cold metal at your neck. You are pathetically grateful for the interruption. It really had been a bore of a book. And your magic reacts instantly to the attacker's presence, so it's not as if you are in any real danger anyway. Within moments, your would-be assassin is disarmed and utterly immobilized. You had spent a not-so-inconsiderable amount of time wondering what your assassin might look like, but never once had you pictured him as being so utterly normal. He is quite a bit younger than you had expected, with a mop of black hair and calloused hands that look better suited to a pen than a dagger. "How did you manage to find your way here?" you question your assassin after your heartbeat stabilizes. "It's my private study. My private study. I know you couldn't have disguised yourself as a servant. I don't permit anyone other than myself to come in here." You shake your head, glancing around your study as you try to work out the puzzle, then disbelieving. "You didn't come through the window, did you?" Your assassin looks positively murderous as he glares at you, which, yes, very in character, but you release the binds of magic on him just enough to let him nod in confirmation. "How dare you?" you hiss. "Do you know how long it took me to convince the Orda Natha to let me have a window in here? They would take any excuse to take it away." You release your hold of magic on your assassin entirely, and his body collapses heavily to the floor. "Go! Get out of here!"
What?
Your assassin says inelegantly. But you hurriedly use your magic to bat him back towards the window, and he eventually starts to get the point.
"This never happened. Do you understand?"
you press urgently. "Never." Your assassin gives you a disbelieving look, but he is at least smart enough not to object. Without further discussion, he shimmies himself back out through your single tiny window, an even trickier task than it appears, considering the width of the palace walls. You spend a moment considering if you could make that squeeze. Probably not, you reluctantly admit. It is only well after your assassin is gone that you realize that, for the first time since you had ascended to the throne, you had forgotten to use royal plurals. Ironically, you rather doubt your assassin would be honored by your condescension. A few weeks pass without any assassination attempts. You would never admit to being disappointed, but... in the dead of night, you are abruptly awakened by the shouts of one of your guards. You jolt awake and jerk to the side a second before a knife plunges into your pillow, sending feathers everywhere. Moments later, one of the guards violently tears your assassin away from you. Your assassin thrashes in his grasp as the guard raises his spear. "Stop!" You gasp a moment before the spear is plunged into your assassin's chest.
"Hold!"
You say the word with your full imperial authority, and the room goes still at once. Your assassin, it is indeed the same assassin as before, glares up at you.
"How did you even get in here?"
you ask him indignantly. Unlike your private study, there are no windows anywhere in your inner chambers, and more pertinently,
we place the wards on the doors to this room ourselves.
"On the doors, yes," your assassin says. His voice is smug, for all that he is now surrounded by your guards. "But not on the secret passages." You stare at him.
"Secret passages? What secret passages?"
A few minutes later, you stare into what is indeed a secret passage that leads directly into your chambers.
"How fascinating," you say, delighted beyond measure. "Did you discover the tunnels yourself?"
Your assassin has no less than 12 spears currently pointed at his body. You gesture the guards back, which they do with the most extreme of reluctances. "With some trial and error," your assassin responds, glaring back at the guards.
I had to study the architectural plans of the palace. They're not shown directly in the plans, of course, but with careful examination, one can make guesses based on the occasional slightly too wide wall. Such lengths you've gone in your attempts to assassinate us, you remark. Your assassin looks away from you and mutters something about your fates being entwined under his breath, and your lips twitch in amusement despite yourself. It's only a shame you put that brain of yours to murdering us instead of being a productive member of society, you add offhandedly. At your rebuke, your assassin flinches ever so slightly, and you study him for a long moment in surprise. Why do you want to kill us so badly? You ask. A personal vendetta? An attempt to destabilize the Empire? It would be a blessing to all the nine worlds if the Empire was to fall, your assassin says boldly. And why is that? You prod. Your assassin squares his shoulders. The entire existence of the Empire suppresses the unassuming magnificence of the common and ordinary good. You interrupt, recognizing the words at once. Your assassin gapes at you for recognizing the quote. Of course you would recognize that quote. You wrote that quote. And then something remarkably like respect flickers across his face. Treasonous words to quote, you say mildly. Despite the assassin having just tried to murder you, the guards still look astonished at the assassin's gall. Your assassin must be thinking along the same line as you, because he only laughs. I've said to your face that the Empire should fall and tried to assassinate you a dozen times. What's another treason to add to the list? A dozen times? You had only counted 10. Why else should the Empire fall then? You ask. Do better than merely quoting Fitzroy Angersell at us. You must have some conclusions of your own to work so steadfastly in your assassination attempts. It turns out that your assassin must have thought extensively on the topic, because what proceeds to come out of his mouth last is a brilliant half-hour lecture on all the foremost evils of the Empire. What a mind this assassin of yours has! You have no disagreement with his words, obviously, though you rather disagree that you dying would solve any of it. And you, your assassin continues, you personally allow corruption to fester within the upper ranks of the palace court. Who's corrupt? You ask. Then, do you have proof? Half the Council of Princes, at least, your assassin spits in disgust. And of course I have proof, not on me, obviously, but it is quite apparent to anyone that bothers to look through their tax records or lack thereof. Tax records? You should have thought to have those audited. How far away is your proof? Do you keep it nearby? You ask intently. Yes, your assassin says. Go fetch everything you have, you say eagerly. We will clear our schedule after the third afternoon bell to go over it with you. Your assassin looks at you blankly for a long moment, before taking an uncertain step towards the secret passage. My lord, one of your bolder guards objects, but you wave him off most firmly. Third afternoon bell, you repeat, do not be late. Your assassin looks towards you for a moment, something indecipherable in his gaze, before nodding and disappearing into the tunnels. Your guards look nearly mutinous when you order them not to pursue, but they are well trained to obey the whims of their god. You had given it 50-50 odds, so it is somewhat of a delight that your assassin actually does return the following day, bringing with him a stack of papers nearly half a foot tall. Your guards react to your assassin the moment they see him, which is as he drops out of your ceiling to land right on top of your startled secretary's desk. Within moments, your assassin is bound with thick chains, the stack of papers torn from his hands. Your assassin doesn't resist your guards at all, only letting out a noise of protest as some of his papers flutter to the ground. More than anything else, he just looks resigned at all the spears now pointed his way. And it does say something of your assassin's character, you suppose, that he was willing to return to the palace to face an almost certain death, if only for the chance of explaining his findings of corruption to you. He seems slightly baffled that you are willing to hear out his evidence at all, but as you have him talk through his findings, that edge of bafflement quickly morphs into a passionate enthusiasm. Laid out like this, the path of corruption is clear as day. "This is well put together. Have you ever considered joining the service?" you ask offhandedly, several hours later as you neatly stack the last of the reports together. Your assassin gives you a withering look, that which, while certainly not amusing to the guards, is admittedly rather refreshing to have directed your way. "I tried to apply," he tells you stiffly. "The examiner refused to come out to such a hinterland region. And so instead of trying to fight that injustice, you went for the logical next step of trying to assassinate the emperor," you say dryly, even as you make a mental note to investigate that claim. "The plan worked just fine on the last two," your assassin mutters. You stare at him. "You were responsible for the deaths of Iritanier and Salier?" "No," your assassin replies unconvincingly. "How?" you gasp. "You would have been a baby." "I was 19, your assassin retorts indignantly, before hastily adding, "Assuming it was me that performed those assassinations, which I am neither confirming nor denying." Your guards show remarkable constraint in holding themselves back from stabbing him in the chest, but only just barely. Which reminds you of something rather important. From the inside of your desk, you pull out a document before placing it in the tray in front of you. One of your servants tiptoes around all the guards to delicately take the tray from you. They present it to your assassin, who looks to you in confusion before craning his neck to examine the paper. Your assassin reads a few lines of the paper before going utterly still. You know well what the document says, having written it out yourself the night before. It is a simple proclamation, explaining in short order that all your assassination attempts had been performed by your command as a training exercise for the guards. It is, in other words, a thinly veiled pardon for the past actions of your assassin. "Do be sure to debrief Commander Bastius on your findings before you leave the palace today," you say, as the commander gapes from behind the assassin. "I'm sure you will have much to tell him." "Yes," your assassin says, looking utterly stunned. And with a flick of your hand, you have your guards unbind him before ending the audience. There are no further assassination attempts after that, though that's not to say that that's the last you hear from your assassin. Occasionally, you wake to find a new report of corruption or injustice neatly laid out on your desk that all your servants swear they didn't place there. And you can't help but notice how the worst of the worst of your court, the ones who had taken a page out of old Eritanier's book, have a tendency to disappear. But you try not to think about that too much. Slowly, ever so slowly, with your assassin's reports to guide you, you start to clear out the worst of the rot that lies at the heart of the Empire of Astandalos. Then the fall happens, and the world falls to pieces anyway. All remnant thoughts of your assassin are buried in the avalanche of dealing with report after report of disaster, plague, starvation. You spend years trying to find your bearings, trying to stave off total societal collapse through single-minded determination. But it is incredibly difficult when you don't have a competent secretary. You had dismissed the last particularly useless one even before he had finished his bows. You pace around your study impatiently as you wait to see who the Master of Offices will dare to send you this time. Eventually, one of your guards thumps his spear. "Cleophras Io Madang, glorious one," he announces as your new secretary enters and makes their obeisances. You glance down at your new secretary and promptly burst into laughter. "Is this another one of your assassination attempts, Cleophar?" you ask, wiping tears of laughter from your eyes, and the already off-kilter guards at the door stiffen rather dramatically at your words. You make a gesture to keep them back, and their training just barely holds true. Not this time, Cleofer mutters, glaring at your feet. I passed the service exams properly, I'll have you know, he adds, almost mulishly. It's rather ridiculous how much pride that news fills you with. Turning over a new leaf? You ask delightedly. There was a fire that needed to be lit, your assassin replies with a deadpan expression. You can only hope that it is a metaphorical fire your assassin speaks of, and that he has not, in fact, decided to branch out into arson. The fall wasn't your doing, I hope? You ask. No, Cleofer objects instantly, sounding scandalized. Of course not. I wanted the Empire to fall, but not like this. You couldn't possibly think. You didn't. Your assassin had always worked so hard to not harm anyone else in his assassination attempts. But it was good to verify. If there was any singular man that could have made the fall happen, it would have been your old assassin. Seeing as that's the case, you say, are you ready to prove that you can do a better job than those who came before us, and help build something better from the ashes of Astandalas? Just don't expect me to fawn at your feet, my lord, Cleofer mutters, but he does rather dutifully take his place at your empty secretary's desk. I rather agree that we are well past that stage, my dear assassin, you say warmly, and together the two of you get to work. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback to the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this Podfix post. Thank you for listening.